अमज्ञानचमिरन्धस्य ज्ञानञ्जनशलाकया चक्षुरुन्मीलितान्येन तस्मै श्रीगुरुवे नमः। श्रीचैतन्यमनोभीष्टं स्थापितं येन भूतले स्वयं नृपगदामयं ददाति स्वपदन्तिकम्। वंशकल्पतरुभ्यश्च कृपासिन्धुभ्यरेव च पतितानां पवनेभ्यो वैष्णवेभ्यो नमो नमः। जय श्री कृष्ण चैतन्य प्रभो नित्यानन्द श्री अद्वैत गदाधर श्रीवासदि गौरभक्तवृन्द। हरे कृष्ण 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 हरे हरे, हरे राम राम हरे हरे। ओ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। ओ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। ओ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। श्रीमद् भागवतम कैंटो 5 चैप्टर 17 टेक्स्ट नंबर 4 Translation and purport by Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. Translation: after purifying the seven planets near Dhruvaloka, the pole star, the Ganges water is carried through the spaceways of the demigods and billions of celestial airplanes. Billions, wow. Then it inundates the moon, Chandraloka, and finally reaches Lord Brahma's abode atop Mount Meru. Purport: we should always remember that the Ganges River comes from the causal ocean beyond the covering of the universe. After the water of the causal ocean leaks through the hole created by Lord Vamanandev, it flows down to Dhruvaloka, the pole star, and then to the seven planets beneath Dhruvaloka. Then it is carried to the moon by innumerable celestial airplanes. And then it falls to the top of Mount Meru, which is known as Sumeru Parvata. In this way, the water of the Ganges finally reaches the lower planets and the peaks of the Himalayas, and from there it flows through Haridwar and throughout the plains of India, purifying the entire land. How the Ganges water reaches the various planets from the top of the universe is explained herein. Celestial airplanes carry the water from the planets of the sages to other planets. So-called advanced scientists of the modern age are trying to go to higher planets, but at the same time they are experiencing a power shortage on Earth. If they were actually capable scientists, they would personally go by airplane to other planets, but this they are unable to do. Having now given up their moon excursions, they are attempting to go to other planets, but without success. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. So I guess from this verse and several verses thereafter, we're hearing about the passage of the Ganges from the hole in the universe that was created by Vamanadeva's toe, and how the passage that the Ganges River takes once it enters the universe, starting with purifying Dhruvaloka, that's what we were hearing previously, and then the seven planets just beneath Dhruvaloka. And then from there are billions of celestial airplanes that carry the water to other parts of the universe. And then it flows to the moon, and then down to the top of Mount Meru, which is where Lord Brahma lives. I guess so the moon must be pretty high up. If the Ganges flows through first the moon and then to the top of Mount Meru, which is where Lord Brahma lives. And then from there comes down gradually through the playgrounds of the demigods, and then to the peaks of the Himalayas, and then through. Sounds pretty far out, huh? So I don't know. That's what the verse is speaking about, the passageway of the Ganges. And then Prabhupada's purport, he took the time to criticize the modern scientists, as he often will tend to do, on this point about how the devas are taking various the waters of the Ganges to various planets by billions of celestial airplanes. So in that particular point, Prabhupada wants to point out, if the scientists were so great, then they should be able to fly to other planets, you know, at will with their machines, but this they are unable to do. They should be able to personally go there. If they're so great, why don't they just go there? And then he brings up, of course, they attempted, or some may believe that they did, go to the moon. And but being on, they've stopped their moon excursions. Sometimes this doubt comes up, if we've gone to the moon, then why not go again? And I think they say that there's water on the moon, right? Do they say like that, the modern scientists? No, I don't know. I'm not on the up and up with these types of topics. In other words, that life may be sustainable there. But after so many years, they have not gone back, and they've given up their moon excursions and trying to go to other planets, which may bring up the doubt, well, we haven't even successfully done anything on this planet. Why go to other planets? I just, Prabhupada's bringing up this point of criticism. Anyway, the interesting thing is that one may wonder why Prabhupada is often led to criticize scientists and Mayavadis, particularly when it sometimes, like in today's verse, it's a little bit, perhaps someone may think it's unnecessary or out of context or not required, especially if one is not so scientifically trained, how can you make comments about all these things? But whenever Prabhupada gets a chance, he's criticizing the Mayavadis and the scientists, particularly. Anyway, so the idea here is that a lot of these descriptions are far out, and that requires faith. And then the criticism of modern scientists and so on, that is to help, that is actually to assist our faith. Because at the present moment, our faith is arrested by the combination and permutations of the modes of nature in the form of various scientific gadgets and achievements and theories. These, the things that are being produced by modern man of science and so on, they're just various combinations of the modes of material nature. Or in other words, they're products of the illusory energy. And but they tend to arrest our faith. And of course, because we generally, nowadays, it's kind of ingrained in us that faith means belief. So oftentimes we may not feel that the various achievements of the modern world have impacted our faith in any way. What does that have to do with our faith? You know, what does a computer have to do with our faith? Or the creation of a spaceship have to do with our faith? Because we generally tend to think of faith as belief. So I can believe in something, and these achievements in modern science don't impact that at all. But the reality is that they've actually arrested our faith. The various achievements, of particularly of science, and their various theories have actually captured our faith, and it's making it hard for us to be spiritually progressive. And how that can be made out is by seeing our determination for the spiritual. In order for determination to be steady, there has to be faith. I think a good example might be, Prabhupada mentioned this point, maybe a good example is Thomas Edison. Is Thomas Edison, he was known to have tried to make the light bulb how many times before, you know, he failed before it, huh? Over 1,000 times? A lot. And I think he was asked, at least I heard like this, I don't know if this is true, he was asked if he's getting discouraged. After trying so many times, you might get discouraged Maybe it was, so let's say 1,000 times. I think it was a little bit less than that, but it was a huge number was there. And he responded to that by saying, no, I figured out 1,000 ways that it doesn't work. And he remained determined to continue to try until he actually became successful. So what was guiding that determination? How can a person be so determined even after failing so many times? Underlying the determination is a conviction or a shraddha or faith that says that it is possible, that it can be achieved. Otherwise, why even attempt it? Unless you were convinced that it could actually be achieved, why would you keep trying even after so many times failing? So underlying the determination is a particular shraddha or a particular faith that keeps one going. So then what happens with modern achievements in the world and various theories also, they arrest our faith by slowing our determination for the spiritual. So although we tend to think that we're very faithful in Krishna, you know, especially because we may have we may be steady in our rituals in Krishna consciousness, which is, of course, indicative of our faith, but then at least some faith. But then other times of the day, we're captured by, you know, frivolity in the form of whatever. There's so many things that are there, particularly with computers nowadays, you know, the internet and the YouTubes and the Facebooks and the MySpace. I don't know if MySpace is even popular anymore. Tweeting. And so on. So in this way, one is infatuated by these things, actually. And so his movement towards Krishna is actually halted on account of movement on the material platform. And then subsequent absorption. Because as we get more and more involved with these things, they tend to absorb our consciousness more and take us away from Krishna. And then so much so that one may become actually satisfied with the fact that I've done my standard amount of ritual in Krishna consciousness. Now the rest of my time will be engaged in whatever, practical affairs involving various things that may not have anything to do with Krishna. So in this way, it becomes necessary for the acharyas, when they're teaching, to make criticisms of the material energy constantly. Although many times people think that it's negative or they don't appreciate the criticisms of the Shastra so much. But the reason that it comes up is because it is actually says something about our faith and Krishna consciousness. If we were actually faithful entities as we tend to think that we are, then such discussion would not be necessary. You can just discuss Leela. But the reality is that because we are captured by the material energy, we it's kind of hard to appreciate that we're in a realm of misconception and misunderstanding. We appreciate it intellectually, of course, because it's kind of evident, but we don't appreciate how we are also captured by misconception and misunderstanding. We don't generally tend to appreciate that so much. So then it becomes necessary for the guru or the acharya to criticize these things in order to educate his disciples. So this is mentioned, one of the qualities of the advanced devotee that we hear from the Nectar of Instruction is that he's free from the tendency to criticize. And so he's an exalted personality. But Shukadeva Goswami, when he opens up his teachings in the Bhagavatam, is all criticism of householder existence. That's how he opens up the Bhagavatam. Maitreya Muni, when he's educating Vidura, he makes a lot of criticism of King Vena and his mentality. He even calls him out by name. It's not like he just said, talked about the principle of atheism or something like that. But he said, King Vena, he's this and he's like that. He actually calls him out by name. So why is that? Why does he do that? Because it's necessary for teaching the disciples or the those who are taking shelter of the spiritual master. It becomes necessary for criticizing in order to free their faith from the infatuation caused by the modes of material nature. And context here in the form of the various theories, the various gadgets created by modern science and so on, which is actually stopping our movement in Krishna consciousness. Before, when life was probably much more simple, it might have been easier to move in Krishna consciousness. There wasn't so much variety of activity to do that was very distracting. But now there's literally millions of things that a person can do to occupy his time now. And that way it becomes necessary for criticizing regularly the material energy or the sciences, as Prabhupada is doing here, in order to try to release our faith from its bondage by the infatuating material nature in the form of these theories and achievements. So Prabhupada is criticized this here. I've heard a lot of devotees, they get sometimes annoyed by this, but I think their annoyance might be also says something of their faith as well. Because why would Prabhupada find it necessary to criticize these things whenever chance he gets? Just like Mayavada, I've heard many devotees get frustrated at why Prabhupada criticized the Mayavadis so much. And that's not the first time the question was asked. Some of Prabhupada's disciples themselves asked, like, why Prabhupada's criticizing the Mayavadis? We don't see any Mayavadis. Where are the Mayavadis at? You know, Prabhupada's been, and then finally one devotee realized, oh, we are the Mayavadis. We are the ones who are having so many impersonal ideas about God and the absolute truth and so on. And therefore it becomes necessary for critique. So the Guru Krishna Prasad Pai Bhakti Lata Bija, he gives the seed of bhakti. The Bhakti Lata Bija means the seed of bhakti. The seed of bhakti is faith and Krishna consciousness. Then under the care of the guru, you know, Diksha Guru or otherwise a Shiksha Guru, under the care of some guru, he's like a gardener. You know, the seed is there, but when the seed is growing, other things grow up with the seed, like the weeds that can choke the seed and so on. So a guru is required to help the germination and further growth of the flower of bhakti that is given in a seed form by the guru. So another guru, or the same guru, he has to see to it that it grows up. And part of seeing to that is criticism is required. And it's not that these things are very disturbing to their mind. Just like Gokulananda was sharing with us when the moon landing happened in 1969, the boys were watching it on TV and they were getting captured by that. Prabhupada, look, they're landing on the moon. And Prabhupada said, you're not massaging properly. He wasn't giving any attention to that. And then the voice was like, maybe he's not understanding the gravity of this achievement. So for a second time there, Prabhupada, they're landing on the moon. He said, but there's direct evidence. Prabhupada said, you're not massaging properly. He was then showing the devotees how to massage. He wasn't giving any attention to that. So the idea is that we are easily captured by misconception, misunderstanding. So then criticism is often used in the Bhagavatam by great souls and so on. And the reason for that is actually just to free up our movement in Krishna consciousness, which has actually become stagnant on account of faith and all these other things, the theories and the gadgets and so on. And we have to admit that that is the case, because you can understand how your movement might be checked when you see various doubts manifesting, when you hear a lot of far-out things in Krishna consciousness. After all, if God exists, then anything is possible, really. Many times people ask us how we can believe in such far-out things. You know, how is it? But if God exists, what is so far out? Just like when we tell the story of Govardhan, Krishna was 7 years old. He lifted the mountain with his pinky finger. He held it there for 7 days. Now, that's a pretty far out story. But how is it that we all can believe in such things? But I often, when someone, I mean, I've been asked this question many times, and my answer has always been that if I can believe in a God who's the source of the whole cosmos, then what is the big deal in believing in a God who can hold a mountain for 7 days? What is it? That is actually a small achievement in comparison than creating a whole cosmos and all the intricacies, which is totally inconceivable to the modern mind. So what is the big deal if Krishna lifts a mountain for 7 days? Or that he can even have a form and so on? So when we are contacting these far-out descriptions in the scriptures, we may see that doubts pop up, and those doubts will actually arrest our movement in Krishna consciousness, especially as they become more acute. when they don't get answers and so on. And therefore, you'll find the acharyas just giving criticisms also of the modern world. That's just to free up our movement so that the seed of faith can grow like that. So all we're hearing about in today's verse is just the passage of the Ganges in the universe, which is quite a far out description. And then Prabhupada is just giving a criticism of modern science. And that what have they achieved? Here it is mentioned, billions of celestials take Ganges waters to the various directions of the universe. But they cannot even go to a higher planet like this. Why he's giving that criticism is what I presented today. So are there any questions? Anyone wants to say anything on that? Or any comments? Yeah.
Thank you for your eloquent description of this verse. Very nice. Oftentimes we see faults in others. We talk about criticism, but oftentimes we're seeing the faults in others, so we're trying to correct them in knowledge. But Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Maharaj, he said that the only reason we see faults in others is because we're honeycombed with faults ourselves. So how is it that we can understand that by seeing, let's say, a fault of someone else, that we also have this fault?
I guess by being a little introspective. Of course, it depends on what is the nature of the fault that you're seeing. Like, for example, someone may say, Prabhu, I see you have a big false ego. And then maybe by being a little introspective and analyzing your own interactions with several devotees or living entities, you might come to realize that you also have a big false ego, and so on. Or if you have a hard time perceiving them, because generally it's harder for us to see our own faults. Just like the stories during the Mahabharata, where I think Dronacharya asked Duryodhana, find someone who is better than you in the military arts. So he went out, then he asked Yudhishthira Maharaj, find someone who is worse than you in the military arts. And they both came back empty-handed. Duryodhana said, I couldn't find anyone that was better than me. And Yudhishthira Maharaj said, I couldn't find anyone who was less than me. You know, so it tells them something about their consciousness. So the idea that is that woman, it may be harder for us to self-evaluate. And that is also due to the influence of false ego. So therefore, it is usually the business of the acharya or the guru to find faults in one and correct them.